This is the new RCR, the Retro Computing Roundtable, Show 21, recorded live in the new year of 2012 on Saturday, January 7th. We're the brothers from other mothers who talk about computer history news and nostalgia, because we're computer historians, hobbyists, and collectors ourselves. I'm your host of the show, and I'm David Grealish. I'm in the Atlanta, Georgia area. Notice I didn't say Greater Carrington. Let's see, I also read the Stan Beats History, the Personal Computer Audiobook Podcast. I produce audio and video at the Classic Computing Podcast, and I recently published my book, The Complete Historically Brewed. So with me today is, who else would it be, but Carrington Vanston in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. He also co-hosts the Double Take podcast and created 1 Megahertz, the Apple II podcast. Plus, we have Earl Evans in Portland, Oregon, and he is the originator of the RetroBits podcast. Happy New Year's, guys.
Hey, Happy New Year.
Hello.
Did you both have a good holiday time?
Mine was
great.
Have
a good holiday time, yeah.
Oh, how about
lots of family and lots of food, and it was fantastic, yeah.
Did you go anywhere over the holidays?
No.
No?
I went to
that's
my family's
good,
house,
right?
But they're just outside of Toronto. They only live up in a little tiny town about an hour from Toronto, so I went out and hung out there. It was totally fun. Love it. Great family time.
My goal was to go almost nowhere, and I met my goal. Had 11 straight days off in a row.
Wow.
And it was fantastic. It was very restful.
11 days?
Yeah, you didn't write
nice.
One.
I took 3 days off.
It was sweet.
Did you get anything special for Christmas? Anything retro related? Probably not, huh?
No, not really. My family sort of only does the gift exchanges by giving gifts to like the kids, like the younger kids. Mm-hmm. Us adults sort of don't exchange stuff between us. So the gifts I got all were things I gave to myself. I was good to me this year though. You know, I knew what I liked best.
You gotta love yourself.
The main thing is I gave myself the parts to finish up the little mini recording studio I've set up in the corner of my condo to be able to do so I've been taking the box opening videos and stuff. I finally have a nice setup for that. So, and it got all complete right before Christmas. So it's been awesome.
You're going to create a whole industry out of box opening.
I don't know about that, but it's been fun recording the openings of the various old Apple II software and stuff. And yeah, I finally think I have it down that the recordings are coming out okay. So mostly that. And Christmas was swell. What about you, David? How was David's Christmas time?
Well, we had a very nice Christmas, and all the kids got something really nice, and my wife got a few nice things, and I got a few nice things.
They all got your book, didn't they?
All
Everybody
around.
Everybody got your book.
Signed, too. That's what made it really special and personal. I actually got, my main gift was, get this, a wedding band after 20 years of marriage, but I've own 2 and lost them. So that's kind of bad. So anyway, now I'm going to have another, you know, I'm going to hang on to this one with life. But, you know, I feel bad not wearing a wedding band. So but it's a real nice one. It's kind of more interesting than what the original ones were. Because the second one I bought, I tried to make it look like look just like the first one. But Earl, so anything special you received for Christmas? The holidays?
For Christmas, I got more on the snack side. I love, Asian culture and particularly Asian snacks. So I got a whole bunch of good stuff there, you know, my wasabi peas and my Pocky chocolate stick biscuits and Starbucks gift cards.
Very
I'm big
cool.
on the Starbucks gift cards.
Cool about the Asian delicacies. That's neat.
Yeah. Oh, and for New Year's, I did my annual tradition of making sushi for the family. This year, I did a bowl kind of sushi. It's not a roll sushi. It's where you mix all the ingredients and the sushi rice and everything like that in a bowl. Huh. This was the Kansai variant of this, the Osaka area. Hmm. So you
I've
just kind
of
chop everything up and mix it all together and
I guess it's called
That's
sushi
cool.
because it's the sushi actually refers to the raw fish, not the form that you eat it in or whatever, right?
Well, you can have sushi without raw fish. Sushi's more just a style and presentation of food. The raw fish in the sushi is called sashimi.
Okay.
So, but a lot of sushi has sashimi of some sort in it, like, you know, raw salmon or raw tuna or that kind of thing. This on this particular occasion, we went with tuna, and it was very tasty, if I do say so myself.
Nice. I just want to mention just real quickly, so where I live, a good 30 miles due north of Atlanta, you know, downtown proper Atlanta or whatever, so in this North Fulton County, it's called, of the area, there's a town called Duluth, and there's a very large Korean population there, and there's a big chain of stores, and I don't know how many they have or how far, you know, does it go out of the southeast or whatever, but it's called H Mart, and they have Super H Mart, so I don't know if either of you guys ever heard of that.
Oh, we have an H Mart that's right by my Starbucks. I love to go there all the time.
Okay,
I love it when they make the fresh deli kimchi. And
oh, man, so... Yeah, so you can appreciate it. It's a really awesome store, and it's a whole bunch of, you know, Asian culture there, obviously, and foods and stuff that you wouldn't see anywhere else. And mm-hmm. and then they have foods from even Europe and other places. So, yeah, we love going there.
Cool.
We don't have H Mart.
You don't?
We don't have stores in Canada. No. No stores.
Well, you need to get
actually,
one.
Actually, well, Toronto has about 5 million people, right? So any kind of cuisine you could possibly want is sold here. So it's one of the nice things about living in such a large city, which is
I didn't even realize Toronto was that big.
I'm totally with you on that.
I knew it was a major city.
Huge.
But I didn't think it was that big.
Fear us.
Yeah. All right. Well, moving along,
And tons of sushi places, so.
So moving right along then in the show, I'm going to announce a little contest we're going to do on the show, our first one. So appropriately, I guess, since I have them on hand, we are going to give away a copy of my book, The Complete Historically Brewed, as well as the first ever copy of the zine Classic Computing that I completed to go along with that in the Kickstarter project. So basically, we're just going to do a standard drawing. So I ask everyone to simply drop us an email. feedback@rcrpodcast.com and simply say, you know, you could just say contest. Yeah, whatever. As long as I know you're emailing about the contest, and then your name will be put into a drawing and we'll announce that next show. And nice. And then send you those things. So that'll be fun. Maybe we can kind of do this more often. We can think of other things.
When's the cutoff that they have to have the email by?
Oh, thank you. You can tell I've never done contests before. Well, I don't know. What should it be, I guess? Since we record on Saturdays typically, I guess it needs to be – how about that Friday evening beforehand? So what would that be, guys? You have a calendar handy? Let's see.
Like the 3rd?
The next show will be the 28th, 3 weeks from today. So how about – so Friday the 27th?
Oh, I got my weeks wrong. Yeah, the 27th.
So I guess just, you know, midnight, you know, 11:59, whatever, you know, as long as it gets to us by the 27th of January. So,
nice.
Okay. All right. Well, starting off into our items of interest and news segment. So I recently did an interview with an important person, so it's worth mentioning. And it was John Sculley, the former CEO and president of Apple Computer. And so that was pretty exciting, and it is posted, and the links are in the show notes. I'm currently working with a major, I'm going to say Apple/Mac blog, you know, website that's going to post it. But I guess just to be safe, I'm not going to mention it just yet because these things might, you know, it should work out, but you never know, right? But hopefully that's going to push it even into the mainstream, you know, and more people will get to hear it. But so our audience will be one of the first to listen to it. It's in two parts.
Awesome. Yeah, congratulations on that, David. That was a real score, a real coup to get that interview. And it's fantastic.
Thank you very much. It's I did realize that my intro is a little long in the beginning, but I think it was necessary, and it also part of it I give with him on the line, so basically telling his history, and so he could have jumped in and said, "Oh no, that's wrong" or something. But I don't do much talking the rest of the time. It's mostly all him for like a good, you know, hour, more than an hour, hour and 15 minutes or whatever. But so just to quickly give the background is with all the recent things about Steve Jobs, his death, obviously, and documentaries and his biography, his book and discussions and so on. And I'm a big fan of Steve Jobs and a huge admirer. Love his Stanford address. You know, everybody should listen to that. It's very inspiring.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But it got me thinking about when I became passionate about Apple and the Macintosh. It was late 1986 and I was on fire and it was all magical. Well, you know, John Sculley was in charge of Apple Computer then, and Steve Jobs had exited already. And I thought that Apple was doing lots of innovation. I thought it was an exciting company, and the Macintosh was exciting. And so basically the interview, I approached John Sculley with to see what he had to say about what I felt like were two major misconceptions. First, that he, quote-unquote, fired Steve Jobs, which is a little more complicated than that. He didn't just say, you're fired, get out. And then the other kind of misconception is that, you know, he ran Apple into the ground. He bankrupted Apple almost. And it's true, Apple was almost bankrupt when Steve Jobs returned and they bought Next. But John Sculley had been gone for well over like 3.5, 4 years or more. So a lot of those things happened after the fact.
But those are widely held perceptions. Most people, if you ask them, who are not very familiar with the story, would say that those are true. John Sculley was ruining Apple, and he's the guy who stepped into the office and chucked out Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
I think most people do think that that's how it went.
And so basically,
anyway, the interview is really interesting.
Thank you. So I approached him with the thesis of I think you did a lot of good things at Apple, and of course I didn't give the guy any criticism, and I don't want to start now, but I mean certainly you could find some criticism of his time there and things, but you can do that with any company.
Steve Jobs, of course, who nobody's ever criticized.
Also in the show notes, you can find a link to an article that Stephen Weyrich wrote at his blog, The Apple II History, where he is talking about the interview, and he writes an article called John Sculley Was Our Friend. And so this is pretty neat, is that by listening to the interview, it kind of changed his mind of his, as a big Apple II guy, of his perception of John Sculley running Apple. Mm-hmm. Okay, so moving along, I'm going to announce one other interview I'm working on, and I hope to have it done, edited and posted by this weekend. But I also interviewed a guy named Bob Cook. And you guys probably don't know who he is, but he was the founder and president of Sun Remarketing. So either of you heard of that company?
Oh, cool. Yeah, of course. Absolutely.
Not you, Earl.
I don't think that I have heard of
them. Well, and that's okay. It's not surprising. But they were a company that kind of most famous for having sold Apple leases after Apple got rid of them. And then there's the whole big story about Apple forced them to bury about 3,000 of them in a landfill to get a tax write-off in 89. But the company basically was an Apple dealer, and they specialized initially in old technology like the Apple III, then the Lisa selling those when Apple ditched them, and then selling older, Apple products for a long time.
And for a long time, like for years and years, you'd see their ads in any Mac-oriented publication, and they were one of the few sources where you could still get like new old stock Apple II gear and that kind of stuff for years and years. So anybody who really played in the Mac space through the 90s and stuff would have and the 80s would have completely seen their ads. Like I couldn't count how many Sun Remarketing ads I saw. I can close my eyes and see their logo. Absolutely, I know them.
Very cool. Him and his company are very much a part of Apple II lore and Mac lore. And a real, real nice guy, real good interview, real nice talking to him. And there's more to the story. So very interesting, worth listening to. So I hope to have it done by this weekend, and it'll be posted. So, all right, so enough about me, what I'm doing.
You're becoming
and all this
Barbara Walters of vintage computing, dude. My goodness.
I can't seem to get him to cry, though, I try, and
you make Earl and I cry all the time off mic. People don't realize what it's like behind the scenes here.
Yeah, we got to be all tough, when we're in front of the mic. But
so Earl, let me hand the magic microphone over to you for our next item.
Well, so everybody this last week was celebrating the 30-year anniversary of the Commodore 64. Carrington, you probably weren't celebrating.
I was going to say everybody, Carrington? He said, raising his eyebrow. Everybody.
Yay! Almost everybody. Everybody but Carrington. which, of course, the Commodore 64, widely known as the most sales of any single computer model of all time, Carrington. And
absolutely. I mean, no arguing with the success of that computer.
But what's interesting is in lots of it, I put one or two links here in the show notes. People can find a whole bunch of links because this was out on Wired and a variety of different tech sites. But there's a question mark that somebody raised in one of the forums, and it was, is this really the 30th anniversary of the Commodore 64? Because this is when it debuted at the CES show, but it didn't actually hit the streets until August of 1982. So so I was thinking, what's the real anniversary? Like when it was announced or when you could actually buy them? Because you guys know over the decades, there have been lots of products that have, even by Commodore, that have been announced at CES, but then never saw the light of day.
And actually, it brings up an interesting debate about, that entire topic. Announced versus shipping. So like another area would be 1977, where you had the Commodore PET, the original Apple II, and the TR-80 Model 1 all were announced in 1977. Well, I guess they all shipped in 1977 too, but how do we judge, you know, who was first and all that based on which dates? Mm-hmm.
Boy, those big three were neck and neck. I don't know
who
actually got out the door first, but that was close. But, you know, let's say that the Commodore 64 had been demonstrated at CES and no one had shown any interest whatsoever. Would mm-hmm. Commodore had still come out with it? And like I say, there were other computers. There's one I'm thinking of in particular. I believe at one CES, they showed off their LCD laptop Commodore computer, the Commodore LCD. And I don't think, I think it was there. And, of course, it never made it to market. And that's true with a lot of companies. So I'm more inclined to judge the anniversary of something as when it shipped out the door. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I'm with you on that one.
I'm a little torn. I tend to agree, and you make a valid point. Like, what if something doesn't end up existing? But I guess in the Commodore 64, it did exist. So it's kind of its saving grace there, is that it really did come to be. So maybe that's one of the exceptions. You can then count its announcement date. But yeah, technically,
tons of things are announced that even demonstrated, but then they become vaporware. Like, that
right.
doesn't really mean the computer exists, or the product, or the gadget, or what have you. Once it's for sale, or at least I can go in a shop and see it, then it's really a product.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. I mean, you know, you saying that and even thinking about it some more, if it's not for sale, if you can't buy it, then technically it doesn't even exist, because it's a product, and a product doesn't exist till you can buy it.
Yeah, so...
You consumer, you.
In any event, happy birthday to the Commodore 64. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'll celebrate again in August because I just like celebrating the Commodore. It makes me feel old, though, because I actually sold it. I was an adult selling these things when they first came out. And I remember the big buzz right before it shipped. And, yeah, we were excited to sell them because the price point for the amount of RAM and capability was... You know, it just blew everything else out of the water. I did wind up selling a bunch of them, but mm-hmm. it's starting to make me feel old. But I guess
lately I've been seeing a lot of ads. Yeah, I've been seeing a lot of ads from the time of the Commodore launch. These things that, you know, they said you couldn't make a computer for this price, but that's only because they couldn't and that kind of stuff. And, you know, really aggressive and interesting marketing helped kick it off. So, and there really is, like I said before, as much as, you know, I've always been in the Apple camp, there's no denying the Commodore 64 is one of the most successful computers of all time, one of the most influential computers of all time. It's still hugely influential in certain music circles and that kind of stuff. I mean, there's absolutely no arguing with the crazy success, maybe not of Commodore as a whole long term, but certainly of the C64. I mean, that is an iconic computer.
Yeah, and also to try to ask, you know, or argue a really overly simplified question, like, you know, what was the best one? Well, this is off the top of my head, and it's not the best analogy, but let's take, you know, a Volkswagen Beetle from the 60s or 70s or whatever, you know, I don't know, at its peak, and then take a, you know, a Porsche or whatever. You know, which one is better? Well, the Volkswagen Beetle outsold it 10 to 1, but that in itself doesn't make it better, but it's better and for different reasons, or each one. Are you seeing what I'm trying to get at?
Yep. Absolutely.
So I'm not necessarily calling the Apple to a Porsche.
No, but at the same time, though, like, I've always argued that the best camera is the camera you have on you. That the fact that I carry around now an iPhone that has a camera, I take way more pictures than I otherwise, because I used to always buy these point and shoots, but I'd leave them at home. So the C64, you could argue, is a better computer than the vast majority that ever existed, because it was the one in a person's household.
Yeah.
Some mythical computer your family couldn't afford, well, that's not better. Some mainframe that you don't get access to, that's not better. So for millions of people, the best computer was going to be the Commodore 64. It's what you got to have.
Yeah, I think that really...
Not getting an Apple.
I think that explains it the best way. And absolutely, for the money, you could not buy, you know... First off, for the money, you couldn't buy an Apple II. And then for the money, that's the best computer in the world you could buy. What would be its next closest competitor in 80s? I guess the TI-99-4A?
Maybe.
At the time, the Atari 400?
Yeah, the Atari 8-bit series... weren't priced too dramatically different than the Commodore. There was still a significant differential, but
but they were more expensive.
After that, it would have been, you know, probably the I don't know, where's the TRS-80 fit in there?
Like the Coco or the Model 1?
Yeah, you
1?
Know, in 82.
No,
I don't
like
know.
The Model 1, Model 3 kind of computers.
But the Coco was cheap. Yes. And the Coco was a very low-priced one. I mean, and similar to the 64, wasn't, you know, hugely expandable in the sense of cards and stuff. It was more cartridge-based. I had a Coco, right. I remember. And that was really aggressively priced. So then you've got the, you know, there was lots of not hugely popular, but very, very eventually very low priced options. The, you know, the Timex Sinclair things and that kind of stuff. I also don't know how well what the things like the BBC Micro, what they were priced at, because that wasn't available in my market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because Carrington, growing up in Canada, well, I mean, is this a fair thing that your marketplace was more like, you know, the UK's than the United States?
No? Oh, totally American. Yeah, okay. Our television is American and our electronics is the exact same as yours. So we didn't get the BBC Micro. The Timex Sinclair ZX, or you guys would call it ZX, 80 and 81, they sold here. I don't know whether they sold in the US. I only know they sold here because I had one. But it was all Apple IIs and Tandy systems and Commodore and that kind of stuff.
I mean, that makes sense. But then on the other hand, you would almost kind of expect there to be a much larger influence of England in general on everything.
But we different electronics, different shaped plug. Like, we're very much wired like America.
Oh, okay.
So we're on your voltage, with the same plugs, that kind of stuff.
Oh, and also, how about your TVs?
We sit here.
NTSC too?
Same thing. Like, everything, yeah. NTSC, everything. Because remember, what we do is we huddle up against your border, terrified of you. Yeah. And every 5 years or so, we all take one step south. We've been, you know, at one point, you guys had all the Great Lakes were yours. And look, now they're half ours. We're just slowly moving south.
Get off me, man. Can't take
it's
them off.
It's going to be a while before they get Atlanta, though, David. So.
We take little metric steps.
You know, every time I go to Florida, where I'm from, it's amazing how many cars you see with Canadian tags, though. I'm like, they drove all the way down here?
See, and you thought it was coincidence.
Nope, snowbirds.
Well, Carrington, you take it away with our next item, which, interesting, sort of ties in with that Lisa story, you know, about burying 3,000 Lisas. So.
Yeah, and maybe what to do with your Commodore 64 and stuff like that. See, people will laugh when they hear what the story's about. The state of Illinois, I'm told that's how it's pronounced. Us Canadians really don't know whether to pronounce the S or not. But the state of Illinois seems to have, from the reports I'm reading, put a ban on all electronics in their landfills. You can no longer get rid of electronics in landfills. So you can't just chuck out old computers or radios or TVs or that sort of thing. The story itself doesn't have a lot to do with vintage computers, but I wonder if it's going to have an effect, significant or not, on the availability of older computers. Because I do think a lot of vintage computers simply get thrown out. People don't want to take the trouble to find someone else who wants it. I couldn't even imagine how many millions of computers have been just thrown away that were still fully functional. Mm-hmm. So this could have an effect on just availability. Because now, instead of chucking in a landfill, maybe people will take it down to a Goodwill shop or something like that. So it could have resonance in at least for the local people in availability of old computers. Who knows?
Maybe, although I'm not sure it's had that effect here in Oregon. I don't know the law exactly. I believe that it is technically illegal here to throw a number of electronics. We have, what are the e-waste laws, I think they call them. Mm-hmm. And as part of that, it mandated that certain organizations, and I believe Goodwill is one of them, have to take certain things from you at no charge. Like if you have a TV or you have a laptop or you have a desktop computer, certain things are exempted from this, like printers and I think fax machines or something like that. But I have not seen that result in an increase in the number of vintage computers available. I think what's happened instead is they've gone to professional recyclers. Like the gentleman that I got the PDP-11 from had actually gotten rid of some other vintage electronic kind of things and had sent them to a recycling outfit. And sometimes I think, depending on the amount of precious metals or other things I think they can recover, sometimes you even get some money from this stuff that you recycle, as opposed to you having to pay them. It just depends on the situation. But, once they get it, then it's stripped out for its constituent parts, and it doesn't remain in its it doesn't stay a Commodore or, a PDP or something like that. It gets stripped out, which is, I think kind of a shame. But
I would think
you have dashed my hopes.
Portland is pretty strict about that stuff. Is that a sort of like California and Seattle, yeah, right?
Yeah.
And then a pretty strong environmental.
Recycling, environmental, all that kind of stuff is a pretty strong trend here.
We have like a storm just blew in here in the last few minutes. All of a sudden, there's lightning outside and thunder and stuff.
And Commodore is flying past.
So I just checked the weather. It's like I didn't realize there was going to be some storm this evening. But all right, so moving along, I guess, Earl, so go ahead. You can talk about the Vintage Computer Festival East.
Yeah, and that's coming up in what, May, I think? The VCF mm-hmm. East 8.0. And
I will check.
You know, always a lot of fun. And I've interviewed them a couple times. You know, we've had pregame and postgame kind of conversations with the crew there that puts together that show. Mm-hmm. And this year they're going to have, as one of the keynote speakers, Thomas Kurtz, who along with, I think his name was Kemeny, at Dartmouth in the 60s developed the basic computer language.
Right.
So I thought this is intense, actually. And I think it's great that while these pioneers are still around and, you know, still with us, that getting a chance to meet them, talk to them, listen to them is a fantastic opportunity. So that caught my eye, and I wanted to bring it to people's attention. That's a real score there for the VCF East.
And actually, we just had our meeting of the Atlanta Historical Computing Society today, and we were talking about BASIC. And then, you know, the two guys, so John, I can't know how to say it either, Kemeny?
I think it's Kemeny.
Kemeny?
Don't quote me on that.
And then Thomas Kurtz. And they designed BASIC in the year of my birth, 1964. But I wanted to look and see how old. Yeah, so Thomas Kurtz was born in February of 28. That puts him a year older than my father. So he's 82, or he'll be 84 this year in February. So, yeah, it's good to be able to have have him speak.
Absolutely.
And VCF East is put on by March, by the way, the Mid-Atlantic Retro Computing Hobbyists. So, okay. So next up, we are going to talk about, and Carrington, you posted this, and that is, so go ahead. That's a pretty amazing sight and picture. I mean, it's really...
I think it's been up for a while. It's one of those things where you just sort of browse on that and I stumble across. Before the show, we were talking about some Soviet-era arcade machines I came across and that kind of stuff. And this site is a virtual... It's based on Flash, so you got to get off your iPads and stuff to look at it. But it's a virtual tour and walkthrough of Michael Jackson's private arcade. And so you can sort of see the kind of arcade machines you can get if you have essentially unlimited funds.
And I guess it doesn't exist anymore, right? Like, it's not there anymore. I mean,
the thing is, there's like, I couldn't find any details. It's just, I sort of weirdly just stumbled into this site that is just this massive Flash walkthrough, all these panoramic pictures that you can click on a different area and it jumps you over there and you can look at there's various sections. It's like this massive arcade. It's got tons of stand-up and cocktail machines and various collectibles and giant Spider-Man figures and just like tons of stuff. It's just like one of those, oh my gosh, I'd love to own this thing.
If I was rich,
really
I would so own this.
The sorts of games I would have gotten. Oh, absolutely. I think all of us probably, and all of our listeners, is one of those things. Like, if you had the funds, all of us would be setting up a Flynn's arcade in somewhere in the back of our houses. And this is just an example of what you could have if you had essentially unlimited funds. Game after game after game.
Yeah.
Lots of them I don't think I would have selected. Some I've never even heard of before. But just a crazy – I'm so envious of that collection. Just absolutely jaw-dropping.
A huge,
just one of those things where it's kind of neat. Yeah, it's kind of neat to see the list of stuff. But I liked the way that this is a presentation. It lets you feel like you're there walking around. Unfortunately, you can't touch anything, but you can stroll around and take a look at the collection. And it's really interesting.
And a very big Star Wars presence.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, in the
and unfortunately, it's all visual, so there's not a lot we can share with the listeners at the moment. But I would urge anybody who's interested in just sort of like what you can get if you can for set up a dream home arcade to head over to the show notes and look at the link because it's really interesting. Unfortunately, I have no background though. All it is this site I just sort of found myself in, and I can't find any other details. But it's interesting.
I want to comment on. So one wall picture here, And I'm sure you can find it easily if you look. But there's a, it says Julian's Auctions, and there's a picture of Michael Jackson standing up with sunglasses on. He's got his white glove. So to his left is the Mona Lisa with sunglasses and the white glove. And to his right is George Washington with sunglasses and a white glove. And then E.T. below him, Albert Einstein and Abraham Lincoln, all with the glasses and the white, and well, this, I guess a glitter glove. What does that mean? Is he one of the greats, too?
I don't know.
I mean, E.T., why is E.T. in
there? Maybe these were all at some point Pepsi spokespeople. I don't know, but yeah. it's a really interesting collection. Like, it clearly, yes. It was one of those things where I think he's famous for being a bit of a kid and could indulge these sorts of whims, and you know, here's what he purchased, and it's outrageous, this collection.
It's very worth looking at, whether you're a Michael Jackson's fan or even just the coolness of the flash virtual reality 3D thing is really
neat. it's really well done. Yeah, it's a really well done virtual walkthrough.
Well, moving on, I just wanted to quickly mention a tweet that I saw from Michael Nadeau, who's been on the show before in the past, and he tweeted about a new Kickstarter project, and so he's got 12 days to go. It's called the Atari History Book, Volume 1, Beginnings to 1984. I haven't had a chance to play the video at Kickstarter, so he mentioned it, and he's supporting it, and I'm going to look into it some more. But it's got a goal of $7,200. It's at $41.95 right now. You have to do $50 or more to actually get a copy of the book. I scrolled down some more, and I saw that it was by Kurt Vendel, who's a longtime Atari collector and Atari historian, and he has been in one or the other or both of the Jason Scott documentaries. So are you familiar with Kurt, Earl?
I just remember, if he's the gentleman you're talking about, I just remember seeing him in the video.
In the videos, yeah.
In the Jason Scott, the BBS documentary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, that's what I thought. So anyway, there you go. And
I'm excited, just to do a side note, that I'm quite excited about Jason Scott's upcoming documentaries.
Excuse me, we'll talk about it a little bit. I, to be honest, I mean, I'm familiar with it, and I know he did a Kickstarter project. Excuse me, but you heard any other news, or what are you excited about?
No, I'm just basically excited about them, the 6502 one in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I know he did that that round of funding through Kickstarter, and it was successful, so
yeah.
That's awesome.
Big time.
And so all three ones will get made, and I'm just, generally excited, because I really enjoyed the BBS one he did, and the Text Files one, the Text Image one.
GitLamp, yeah, I did the same
thing. GitLamp, shit. I've got my GitLamp coin. I just, I really dug them, and I love that. I just, I like that he's got a big personality, and I like that he's got opinions, and I like that he's making these documentaries, and just, it's one of those things where I'm just really happy that somebody like that exists, and is being a real force in the community. So just, it makes me pleased that he's going to be making more documentaries.
Indeed.
Yeah, no, I'm a huge fan of his work too. So I fully expect these to be, great as usual.
Mm-hmm.
And so the three that he's doing, one's called Tape, a documentary with bias, and then the 6502, and then Arcade. And so he raised $118,000 in middle of November for $100,000.
I'm less interested in the Tape one, but who knows? Who knows what it'll be when it's done? But the Arcade one and the 6502 are right up my alley. I'm really excited about them.
Mm-hmm.
So, did you guys see the QA session on that? It was, I think, on Vimeo from when he came to Portland.
On the GitLamp with you
when he was doing the tour. Yeah, that was a lot of fun having him here in town, and the screening that we got. And then a particular interest was the QA session afterwards, where he spoke for a while and answered questions. And
I saw it. Yeah,
I got to interact with him a bit at Kansas Fest, and it was really fun because, as you know, my own podcasts, not just One Megahertz, but anything I've sort of done, and the Double Take one and all that, I always release to the public domain, no copyleft, no Creative Commons, nothing. It's literally, do anything you want with it, including cut out my voice and say that you wrote it and sell it. Yeah. You can literally do anything.
That's what
you
I do
want,
personally.
I don't care.
But
I'm just Well, I sort of, my general philosophy is I just want to throw it out there, and I really am not bothered if somebody wants to do literally anything with it. But I got to have a good discussion with Jason because I was always unclear, like, well, what is the difference between public domain and just no copyright or copyleft and all those sorts of things? I'm still a little unclear, but he helped unmuddy the waters a little bit. Didn't convince me to do anything else. Like he's a good advocate for other sorts of copywriting and Creative Commons, that kind of stuff, and sort of helped me look at some of the Creative Commons ways of doing it that would be appropriate for what I want, which is essentially complete no restriction. But it seems simplest in the end just to say, ah, it's public domain and anybody can do anything. But it was a really good conversation, and I liked that he was there to discuss that and other things, and just, you know, he's a good guy.
It's interesting. You know, the reason I do Creative Commons on RetroBits was to let people know that they could do something with the show if they wanted to. It was, you right. know, I because there's lots of podcasts where they don't really mention how they're licensed, and you're left
like this one?
Kind of yeah, like this one and many others. And I'm not necessarily criticizing. I'm just saying if you wanted to use derivative material, if you wanted to say excerpt a couple of minutes
right.
from. You know, one of those things, you're left wondering, gosh, am I okay to do it?
But, like, what's your stance, for instance, Earl? Somebody takes one of your podcasts or takes all of your RetroBit podcasts, sticks them on a CD, and makes it available for $10.
That'd be fine. And I believe that well, it depends on if the $10 wow, it's an interesting – that'd be an interesting interpretation of Creative Commons.
Because now they're profiting from it. Exactly.
Right. And yeah. My Creative Commons license that I use is non-commercial, share-alike, with attribution, which means
– So it's non-commercial. They can't sell it.
If it's right. non-commercial, it means they can't make money off of the work that they derive from my work, right? You know, they could make the right. argument that the $10 is shipping and handling kind of thing. But it's not like they yeah. could take RetroBits, package it in something, and go make thousands of dollars off of it because the non-commercial aspect of a license would, you know – stop them from doing that.
Because I'm going to be offering for sale very soon collections of RetroBits.
Excellent. Well, and also keep in mind that Creative Commons also doesn't have to be the only exclusive license. Like, you know, if somebody were to contact me and go, hey, you know, I want to sell RetroBits for $1,000. Can I get written permission? I could give them permission to go above and beyond what the thing is. It's just that this is a license that you could use. If they get permission from the copyright holder, it's the sky's the limit on what you want to let people do. So I didn't feel that it boxed me in any way, but it did let listeners or possible reusers of the content know what they could do with it, and that's why I liked it. So sorry for that right. aside, but that
No, I think it's an interesting thing, and I think it does – I mean, in a broader scope, these issues really impact collectors and fans of vintage computers because we're all dealing with the fact that most computers had copyright – or most software had copyright restrictions on it. Now, the company that made it might have been out of business for 15 years, but is it okay to crack or not crack that software? Is it okay to distribute? Is it okay to make it available on a website? Site and what happens if you can't get a hold of the copyright owner? Copyright issues are becoming more and more of a thing, I think, in the retro computing, fandom or hobby collections or whatever you want to call us.
Right.
So for me, what I want to do with my personal work is simply say, it's just available. Just do anything you want. Remix it. If I get killed, you don't have to worry about trying to find the executor of my will to find out if it's okay to put it on a website. You can do anything. You can put your name on it. You can sell it. You can mix it. You can excerpt it. You can make fun of it. Mystery Science Theater 3000 style. You can do anything you want. Off you go. But that's not that I think that everything should be that way. That's just what I want to do with my work. But I do find lots of times I'll listen to a podcast and think, well, what are the restrictions here? Could I pass this to my friend or do I have to point them to the website and that kind of stuff? But just anyway, I find it interesting. And Jason Scott has a lot of really interesting opinions about this. Not all of which I agree with, but I find him a very interesting advocate for making sure that the history of computers is well documented. And he's coming from that perspective. And it's just a really interesting guy to bring it back to Jason Scott.
I don't know a lot about this issue. I guess my opinion would come down to, so my attitude would be like, yeah, share and share alike, and that's all cool and everything, as long as you're not, so like specifically software, if the company is not currently trying to profit from it, like they have no intention and in no way are they trying to sell it, then I think it kind of I know not legally, but puts it into the public domain. So I mean, as long as you're not denying someone else from making money off their product. So for instance,
maybe
a book,
you do.
Or,
like, if you make it available, though, maybe that stops the company. Like, for instance, if you look at In Exile, the publishing company that came out with that Demon's Forge thing that sort of sank without a trace. And the guy behind In Exile is the fellow that was behind Wasteland, one of my favorite games of all time for the Apple II, also behind The Bard's Tale, that kind of stuff. They're about to launch very, very, very shortly Choplifter HD. So it's like new 3D version of Choplifter that will be available for PlayStation and that kind of stuff. But Choplifter, of course, I think of as an old 8-bit game that I played, 20 years ago or something like that. That game hasn't been for sale forever.
Right.
So, but here we are. Somebody else, no doubt In Exile, had to license the rights for Choplifter. So there was still value in the Choplifter.
Yeah.
Name. It was still a commercial property. Maybe if Choplifter had been ripped off like crazy, it would have devalued it such that In Exile didn't want to buy it. Like, I don't know. Like, I'm a Canadian, so I'm basically a big commie to you Americans. So I don't know.
Well, it's a complicated.
I find it an interesting sort of thing. Yeah.
It's a complicated issue.
It's a very complicated thing. Yeah.
Like, as far as our podcast here, my attitude is it's absolutely free and distribute it all you like. If I found out somebody was like editing it to pretend that they were in the show with us or something, it would bother me a little bit. I don't, I'm not going to say it wouldn't bug me, but.
And for the listeners at home, what's ironic is they don't realize, Earl and David, that I edit myself into this podcast each time. So don't tell
them. We'll stop you. But I think, when you're talking about a product where someone created it and to improve their lives by way of profit, making money, and then. Mm. If someone's doing something with it that's potentially denying them that or cheating them out of it or something, I don't know. Like a book.
I do see that as a different issue, something that is a for sale. Like for instance, like a book, absolutely.
I mean, like if someone right now,
I'm giving away for free.
My book does not exist in a ebook or a public PDF, or even if it did and someone bought that and then started giving it away, then I'd be upset about it. Or let's say they take my real book right now and scan it all in and start giving that away. Then they're denying me.
I agree. It's different, I think, when you come from a point where something is a commercial property for sale. Like, you currently have put a lot of effort in, and you have a book that you're willing to sell to people. Mm-hmm. And I do see that as completely different than, say, my podcast that I put very little effort into and I give away for free to start with. It is a free thing.
But yeah, Jason
Scott, they are completely different things.
He essentially gives away his videos.
Mm-hmm.
And now, in my case, being a fan and enjoying them, I wanted to own them. I watched the BBS one numerous times before I owned it. And now,
me too.
Get Lamp, I bought right off the bat to support him, and because I really wanted to own it, and I also wanted to be a part of that, being one of the first people to get it. But then I eventually bought the BBS one because I wanted to support him and I wanted to own it.
Right. You look at like the books of Cory Doctorow, where he gives them away for free at the same time as making them available as a print copy if you want to purchase it. And I mean, there's lots of approach. Anyway, I find the whole topic very interesting from a standpoint of all of us are sitting on like software that we want to play that is maybe unavailable and will be. And as the hardware that plays it becomes unavailable, 30 years from now, how does somebody play a game that I love, like the original old Portal game or Wasteland or something like that?
Right.
When there's a disc and no hardware anywhere that's available to play it. And the only thing that exists are essentially cracked disc images. And anyway,
I've got lots of thoughts on this myself. I think, it probably boils down to though that my personal opinion. So this is, I'm prefacing it with that, is that the concept of copyright in particular has been distorted from its original purpose, which was to promote the creation of arts and sciences. I mean, if I think about it from a U.S. perspective, it's actually in the Constitution that, you want to give people limited, exclusive rights to their work for exclusive rights to their work for a limited period of time is the way it's stated.
Right.
And that limited period of time has been creeping up and up to the point where it's ad absurdum. You know, where, you know, you're talking about something being copyrighted for 90 years plus.
Don't bring up Walt Disney, Earl.
You know.
Well, yeah, but is it every time Mickey Mouse comes up?
Don't you start beating up Walt Disney production?
That's exactly what it is. And the thing is, you know, if the purpose of copyright is to promote the generation of these works, then the maximum amount of time they should be under copyright is the minimum amount of time that will still promote the creation of the works, but then allow them to seep into the public domain. Not like, you know, having them on copyright for 200 years so that people who didn't even have anything, who aren't even the great grandkids of the people who invented the thing, still being able to milk them.
But you know what? Just right. To play devil's advocate just a little bit, what is the, you know, and this might be a silly example, but let's just say copyright is ownership, right? I make something, I have copyright to it. No, you can't take it and go do whatever you want or make money out of it because it's mine. So how is that different than I build a house and I live there and I raise my children and I die, now it's theirs, but they didn't buy it. Do you see what I'm saying? It's property. So why do I ever lose ownership? And therefore my descendants or, you know, inheritors or whatever. Why should you ever lose?
The Constitution said limited time.
Yeah, I'm just, again, playing devil's advocate.
Part of it is that
they intended these things to time out.
No, I understand. I'm just saying, making an argument, devil's advocate argument, about if you own something, why should you ever lose that ownership, though?
But copyright really isn't ownership, quote unquote. It is a exclusive rights for a limited period of time.
Yeah.
Other people get to have houses that look like yours too now. Well, because when copyright runs out, you don't lose the ability to have your own stuff or sell it. Like, that never gets taken away. What you lose is the monopoly power of no one else gets to.
I guess I was trying to make the point of looking at it as property, as a, you know.
Which is always dangerous when you're dealing with intellectual property, because, you know, if I make another house that's nothing to do with yours, you're not losing it. Well, yeah. I can devalue your ability to sell your house if I'm also selling your house. So I get that too.
Yeah, it's not a perfect example either, because I can't, like you say, I can't start cranking out duplicates of my house and then I don't own those duplicates. And
And that's one of the primary,
but it's interesting,
metaphors that gets used in the copyright. Whenever discussions about this come up, it's always a point of contention to what extent you can compare intellectual property with tangible real property.
Right.
You know, and it can be in some ways dangerous to make those metaphors because, like you say, if I can make a Xerox copy of your house, it costs you nothing other than possibly your monopoly to have a house that's constructed like yours is and, you know, the cool things about your house, which the founders, you know, meant for this to enrich the public so that more works would be generated and eventually fall into the public domain, as opposed to having these things kept under a rock for 100 years. I mean, that was the original
intent. You're right. You know, if you think of it that way, if the point of copyright is to encourage the creation of things because it will enrich society and eventually go into the public domain and everybody will get stuff, then if it's never going to fall in the public domain, then we're getting nothing out of it as a society to promote those things. So you can say, well, if you're never going to give it to me, why do I want to have a law that encourages you to promote it? Not that I think it necessarily does encourage people to promote stuff, because a lot of stuff got made in the Renaissance. There was no copyright then. Yeah. But the big issue I have is that we retroactively add time to existing copyrights. Because clearly, if somebody made something 30 years ago under that existing copyright, that was enough to motivate them to do that. We don't have to give them extra time. Because that was enough time to motivate you to make that book. I don't need to tack another 70 years on. I could see maybe arguments for it. We want to say increase it so anything created now gets a longer time because we're hoping to make more creation. But whatever got made in the 30s and 40s and 50s, existing copyright law was sufficient to motivate them to make it. They don't need more incentive.
Well,
and also, when you're dealing with Disney, it's really ironic that I can't think of a single Disney movie that's not based on older public domain works. The Hunchback of Notre Dame and Sleeping Beauty and all these things, Snow White, they used public domain. And then they said, oh, but now it's copyright because we did. Oh, hold on. So clearly public domain thing does help people build upon stuff.
You know what? That is so funny. That's a really good point because I was about to make the point. So and not to counter that at all, but to go along with what you're saying, though, but as a Disney fan, which I am, it's not that big of a deal to me, but I don't think I'd like other people, non-Disney people or the mess around with Mickey Mouse or whatever, or to use their, you know, their stuff, if you will, like that. But then you make a really valid point. So, for instance, a movie that was in my head that was, because it was 50 years old or whatever, is like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and the iconic, you know, Nautilus.
Mm-hmm. Iconic, public domain works by Jules Verne.
You're
so
right.
Why doesn't Jules Verne get to say, no, you don't get to make that movie. I'm 300
you're
years
absolutely
dead.
Right.
And still, like, well, maybe not 300, but still. Anyway, not that I think... Well, maybe I do personally think all copyright is bad, but I don't think everyone should agree with me on almost anything. But I do find it weird that we'll go back and give more copyright to something that already exists. That I can't really even get my head around.
But just to close this out, I guess, and doesn't resolve anything, but...
Well, does this have to do with that Atari book?
Well, it's a topical thing. But Mickey Mouse, then, is not, you know, somebody, you know... Disney Studios, Walt Disney created that. So that's an original creation, Donald Duck and all that. So I would tend to sort of be on their side, at least with that, about that they should always retain ownership of that, that just anybody else can't just do what they want with them. Though I believe in, if you create laws, you should stick by them. And I don't know, people shouldn't have.
I've always kind of liked that idea that's got bounced around the states a bunch of times, that to keep copyright, you should have to pay a tiny little sum every year, even if it was like a dollar, so that you would at least have a one place you could go look to see, is this book under copyright? Has somebody been paying the $1 or one penny or something? Because it's so
sort of like
I find a book from 1920, it's so hard to know, is this somebody's work? Is this under copyright? Can I use it? Can I not use it? Because there's no central repository for it. Yes, it's definitely free. So everybody's afraid to use anything. So it'd be nice if there was at least one place where, even if it was so cheap, like if it's not worth a dollar a year to you, then clearly you don't care whether it's still copyrighted, or a penny a year or something.
Well,
that's an interesting thing, but it doesn't seem to be getting any traction in the States.
I'm going to close out this topic, but let's invite our listeners to email us with your comments. Mm-hmm. And how about next show? You know, I can't promise to read them all, but maybe we'll read a few of those.
Invite our listeners to edit themselves into this show.
Oh, yeah. You know what? Or send audio. We've never done that before. So you can certainly email us or send us audio that we can play.
Oh, that'd be fabulous.
RCR Trance Remix.
Right. Remix yourself into the show and send it to us. Anyway, all right, so Earl, you take the last topic. Sorry it took so long to get here. So the C-116 video with Bill Hurd.
Well, so Bill has been putting up a lot of different blog postings here recently on C128.com, and he was the primary engineer behind the Commodore 128, did a bunch of other work at Commodore as well. And I thought this C116 video was interesting. There were a couple of computers that Commodore made, successors to the Commodore 64 in a sense, the Commodore 16 and the Plus 4. And depending on how you measure it, they kind of flopped in the marketplace. And part of it was that they weren't compatible with the Commodore 64, which was, you know, you got to look at that sideways and wonder, wow, what happened there, from both a hardware and a software level. But it's interesting in this video that Bill kind of tells the story, hey, when we were creating this particular model of computer, we weren't trying to eat the Commodore 64's lunch. We were going at a low cost, like a $50 machine, something to compete with like the Timex Sinclair and, you know, the other like ultra low cost things that were either coming out or rumored to be coming out. And that's the market we were going at. And then after Jack Tramiel left Commodore and the marketing people kind of changed things around, the Plus 4 and the Commodore 16 came out at price points that nobody would have thought the market would have sustained, especially the fact that they weren't compatible with the Commodore 64 that had a gajillion software titles. At any rate, it's interesting to watch this video and get not just some of the engineering stuff, which is fascinating in and of itself, but also some of the backstory on how this line of computers went sideways. And Bill does a really interesting presentation, opens up the computer, shows you inside, tells you about some of the stuff he worked on, and I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah, he looks fairly young to me. How old is he?
Well, I'm not sure. I think he was pretty young when he was working at Commodore,
so maybe
in the 80s.
In his 20s, yeah. So, yeah. Very cool. If you scroll down, too, you can see that. So he also links off to like a video about Chuck Peddle, father of the 6502 and evil genius. And then a couple below that, Retrobit Show 100, an interview with Bill Hurd.
Yeah, Bill and I had a great chat, too. I think that wound up being a three-parter because we kind of went on, and it was fun stuff.
Yeah, so everyone may want to check that out. All right, really cool.
This is weather, one of nature's ever-changing mysteries. It affects every one of us every day of our lives, and yet we know relatively little about it. Weather, that's something we'd all like to do something about, isn't it? And so tonight we've brought you down here to Remington Rand's New York Computing Center in order that we might show you that something actually is being done about it. The hero of our story tonight is the giant electronic brain developed by Remington Rand, UNIVAC. Now, recent experiments show that future use of UNIVAC may give us faster and more accurate weather predictions than were ever possible before. You see, UNIVAC can take the past histories of thousands and thousands of storms, analyze them, compare them with developing conditions, and make predictions, all in a matter of minutes. Calculations that would ordinarily take hundreds of man hours to complete. Data from guided weather rockets, radar observation stations, weather stations, all of this can be fed into the computer through these magnetic tapes at a rate of 12,000 numbers or letters per second. The memory tanks make immediately available 12,000 additional units of information. And all of this complex weather data is analyzed in the heart of the UNIVAC, the electronic central computer, capable of making over 2,000 mathematical calculations per second. Now, here is where we get the answers. You might call it the voice of UNIVAC. Actually, it's a high-speed printer that prints results at the rate of 600 lines a minute. So you can see that UNIVAC is both fast and versatile. But most important is the assurance that UNIVAC will give you the right answer. And that's made possible by UNIVAC's unique ability to check itself on possible errors. Let's watch right now as UNIVAC puts itself through one of these self-examinations. Here it is checking on some of its own units. It's really an amazing system, isn't it? Amazing and yet so wonderfully practical. Remington Rand makes four basic UNIVAC models: the general purpose UNIVAC, which you've seen tonight, UNIVAC Scientific, UNIVAC File Computer, UNIVAC Punch Card Computer. Each of them capable of literally hundreds of applications, from weather forecasting to complete business control. Today, UNIVAC is saving time and increasing efficiency for business, industry, and government. And of course, that is the business of Remington Rand.
So, moving right along. Carrington, why don't you tell us about your auctions from last time? I think we're going to do it this way from now on.
Sure. I went expensive and nothing sold. So I did two quick choices. One was an $8,000 choice, a thing called an Interact home computer with the box, with the manual.
Still there.
Interesting computer from 1979, and it's still available, and they still want $8,000. So it's just sitting on eBay. Nothing's happening to it. And the other one I chose
was more interesting. It's had 15 offers, by the way.
Yeah, 50 offers, and he keeps turning them down. He's holding out for his $8,000. The other one I chose was the Podbricks, the little Lego custom minifigs. Podbricks, the one of Steve Jobs and Woz, the little Apple playset, and it was number one of 300.
Yeah, so it was much more reasonable.
Yeah, very collectible one. Looking for $1,500, and unsurprisingly, that also has not sold. So complete auction failure on my part for last week. We will see if I do better this week. Or this episode.
Yeah, and six offers on that one. And I think we said this last time too, where it doesn't seem that you can make offers on it now. It doesn't have a make offer button.
He had six offers. He said, that's it. No more offers. Give me my $1,500.
Oh, actually, you know what? I believe that's a limitation. That's an eBay limitation. I think you can only get so many offers. Maybe it's six then. Oh, no, that's not right, because the other one has 15. I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and the other one still has a make offer thing available too after 15. So I think it's just that the seller for the Podbricks is tired of getting offers.
So moving along to mine, basically what I did was I just did a search for next, as in like the next computer under the vintage computing category. So there's nothing really to talk about as far as results, other than I clicked on it. So if you click on it, you know, right now or soon, there's 50 results there. I don't really see any computers.
Did they sell?
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess if I looked at complete... Oh, yeah, there's some in here. Oh, yeah, no, because remember there was like a $1,000 one. That looks like it's still there, a $2,000 one. There's another Turbo Slab. Right now, buy it now for $495, our best offer. That's not too insane, but still kind of high. But anyway, so you can look at that. So, Earl, you go ahead with yours.
Well, I had a IBM Magnetic Core Storage Square, and it's
so
sold.
Beautiful.
It sold for $141.50, and it was really a nice-looking one.
Yeah.
It came from an IBM System 360, which is a historic machine in and of itself. So, yeah, some lucky person got that.
A fairly large one, too.
I think that's a good price for that. I know it's maybe not a very useful thing, but I think it's – and even from forgetting the collectible value, it was gorgeous, something you not only collect but I think display. I thought it was just such a lovely piece.
I agree, and I do think $141 is not a bad price for that at all.
Mm.
And if you click on see his or her other items, they have another one for sale too right now. One day, 23 hours left, $115, no bids, buy it now, $140. So you can still get one. All right, so now we're going to talk about this time's auctions, and Carrington, you go first.
I've gone expensive and strange once again. This time I'm picking a mechanical tube computer from an old B-29 bomber Super Fortress. I have no idea how collectible this thing is or what its provenance is or whatever. The listing says that it was purchased legally at a government surplus auction or something along those lines. It's got a lot of photographs. It's just such an interesting thing. I never really thought of an old B-29 having a mechanical computer inside it. It's labeled for which gunner turret or whatever this was helping control or something. It's a big chunky blob of a computer, and I found it really interesting. They want $1,000 for it, but they will take offers.
Yeah, some relays and tubes and
that honestly is just awesome to look at.
Isn't it cool? I've never
it really is.
Anything like that.
Yeah, it'd make a very cool
$700 shipping to Canada though, so
just like to put it in the entryway of somebody's office or something, like a piece of art. You know, with a
It says that it was parallax adjusted for the B-29 left blister sighting station. That's what is put on it. It's model 2CH1C5-L. And it's just – it's cool. It's really neat.
Yeah, and it's got some interesting history here. So it talks about how before the B-29, bombers such as B-17s and B-24s had to have a gunner for aiming and firing the guns for each particular turret. So this took the place of that. I guess I'm not reading the whole thing, so go read it.
I have no idea. I wouldn't even want to wager on whether or not this is going to sell, but I thought it was an interesting enough thing to just make my pick to sort of bring to everybody's attention, because I thought it was a cool listing.
I like it.
Yeah.
We'll revisit it in 3 weeks and see what happened.
We'll see.
So, Earl, you go next.
Well, I got a couple, so I'll be brief on them. One is for a Seagate ST-225 hard drive. Actually, I've been looking for one of these myself because I've got a controller card for that DEC PDP-11.
Mm-hmm.
The card's called the RQ-DX3, and with some creative circuitry, I can connect up an ST-225 and use it as the hard drive for that computer. So personal interest, but also I picked this because there was a recent thread on the Vintage Computer forums about the ST-225 and what a bulletproof drive it seems like. A couple of people said, no, I don't really think so. I've had some fail on me. But most of the people in the thread said, yeah, this ST-225 in my system's been working forever. Yeah, you know, they just, they're like a workhorse. So I know I installed dozens of these things into IBM PCs when I worked at Hughes Aircraft in the 80s. We had the ST-225, was a favorite. Also the ST-251. The 40 megabyte version was also a bulletproof and a faster sibling of this guy. So
I was just looking it up because I thought maybe it might have been the one that was in the Apple profile hard drive, but it turns out it was in the Apple Hard Disk 20SC, which was the first.
Oh, I had one of those.
Really, yeah. I had a 20SC on my desk.
Yeah, which is the first.
I had a 20SC as well.
Mac Plus SCSI hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
Had that cool inside of it.
And the DEC drives were just a little bit of extra circuitry and deck putting a box around some very common hard drive models like the ST225, ST251, a Micropolis drive, a couple different models there. So, you know, like an OEM rebranded sort of thing. That's why if I can get me one of these 225s, it'll work as long as I build just a little circuitry with a diode and that kind of stuff.
You got to stop telling people about it.
Yeah, because they'll all bid it up, right? The thing that I've seen on eBay is some ST225s and 251s going for ridiculous prices,
yeah.
Like the remanufacturing companies. I want one, but I'm not going to pay $500. Or I think one was $1,500, and I just said,
Oh my gosh.
It reminded me of this Charlie Brown cartoon where Lucy is selling lemonade for $5 a glass. And I think Charlie Brown says, you're not going to sell many glasses at that price. And she says, I don't have to sell many glasses at that price.
And let me interrupt again, Earl. I just did a search on eBay for ST225 under, you know, computing. Yeah. So right now there's an external SCSI drive contains ST225 hard drive. That's what its title for buy it now, $45.
Ah, cool. But I don't know if that's like, is that a special version of the 225? Because I looked at that and I was thinking, is that just the standard drive?
Yeah,
is that,
I don't know. It says ST225N on it, and then it has a very blurry picture of the enclosure.
Yeah.
And and who knows if it works. Just because it lights up doesn't mean it works.
Well, that's true. You gotta test it. So the other one that my other option is for a manual portable IBM card punch. And
this is really cool.
If you've ever seen a key punch machine, it's this gigantic thing with a keyboard and the cards go through and, you know, it would take up a whole corner of your room. Whereas this little guy is just a little box that you open up. Now, you do have to punch the individual slots on the card manually, but you could, with some effort, kick out a punch card with one. And the interesting thing is, back in the day, again, that's making me feel old, I could actually look at a punch card and read the Hollerith codes on it. I didn't have to have the little print at the top. I could tell you what was on it. And so one of these things had been perfect. I'd have been, you know, punching out cards like crazy.
Yeah, what do you think the purpose of this was? I mean, because how much data would you actually put on it? Or for what reason would you...
Quick revisions, maybe? Like you want to just replace a couple of cards?
Okay.
I think so. I mean, I certainly wouldn't.
It's in a lab as well for a school.
Yeah, I wouldn't kick out a 200-card deck with this, huh?
Yeah, no. So maybe like not a technician, but maybe a programmer or somebody, and they're running it through and they find a problem.
It was made for Earl. Earl was the entire market for this. He only made the one, and now finally Earl and it have been brought together through eBay.
It's resurfaced, yeah.
So Earl, cough up your $300, which is starting bid price.
I will get on it. Yeah, so, a little pricey for my taste, but I just thought this was so fascinating.
Yeah, so prediction, will it sell?
I don't think
so. Will we check back?
I don't think it's going
to. We need to remember to start doing this. Carrington, will your sell?
No.
No.
No one's going to buy the Super Bomber thing. If I had the money to buy Michael Jackson's arcade, I would also buy this. But that's it. It's expensive. And, I mean, really, what are you going to do with it other than look at it and own it? But it's cool.
All right. Well, moving along to my choice. So forgive me. But listen, it's a good thing I did here, but I sort of cheated. I've done it before. What the heck? So I did a search for in looking for something for this show, I did a search for Byte Collection under Vintage Computing. So I was looking for a collection of Byte magazines. You know, maybe someone would have a decent deal on a stack of them. I didn't go through all three pages here, but I didn't necessarily find that. But if you look at the link, you'll see there's a whole bunch here at $299 buy it now or best offer. And you know what? I did not look to see if they'll combine shipping. I would think they would, but any old Byte for $3 is a pretty good deal nowadays. I mean, so is it all the same? Anaheim, California. I can combine shipping, it says. There you go. And some
of them. So much fun to go back and read.
Yeah, and some of them have the Robert Tenney covers, you know, which were original artworks that he painted to go on the covers. So, yeah, really a lot of nice ones here. So you can, for not a lot of money, buy a Byte collection, maybe separately, but from the same guy, maybe, and combine them. Yeah, all $299. This person just wants to sell them, you know, and get rid of them quick.
Yeah, some really great covers.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all the same person. Quality Wholesale Outlet 2011.
Okay.
They're going to need to change their name.
Sounds legit.
So take a look, won't you?
Well, then... And free for the first 500 callers.
Well, I think we're coming to the end of the show. Do either of you have anything you'd like to add or discuss
just,
with me?
Just one parting shot.
You haven't talked long enough? What's a parting shot?
I read the book, the textbook, actually, that I used for assembly language in college back in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
I read it again. Assembly language for the PDK.
Did you graduate this time?
I passed this time again. Yay, woohoo! And it was a lot of fun, actually having the text that I had back then and going through it. It's material I wanted to know because I want to program this PDP thing. So, yeah, that was a kick. I just have one more half chapter, and then I think I'm done with the book.
Cool.
Very nice.
Yeah, you need to tweet some pictures or send them to me to stick in the show notes.
I do need to do that, and I will.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess that's going to do it for this. I always want to say episode. Are these episodes? Let's discuss that.
Sure.
Are they really? Is this a podcast episode or just a show? I always want to say episode though. But so okay. Well, this wraps up another episode of the Retro Computing Roundtable. So thanks everyone for listening and supporting the show. Please tell a friend or two about it. You can find all the discussed links in the show notes and write us an email. Go after the contest for the book. Give us your comments about copyright law and software and all that, and Creative Commons and so on. And we do read all of your email, even if we can't always reply. So keep writing. You can email us, by the way, at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And you can follow us, which we're working on doing more tweeting from there, at RCR Podcast. So until next time, Retro Compute.